So today I interview an old colleague of mine, Greg Reby, who is a consultant and a business angel based out of Western Australia. Greg is a consummate professional. He's extraordinarily insightful in the workings of innovation, entrepreneurship and business in Western Australia. He's a well-connected individual, and I think he's got some insights that would be very interesting to listeners. Please enjoy my interview with Mr. Greg Reby. Welcome, Greg Reby. It's pronounced Reby, isn't it? It's not Reby.
Reby. Yes. No, it's definitely Reby. Yeah.
Thanks for making the time to talk to me today. For those few people that are listening right now, maybe just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do.
Thanks, Peter. What I'm doing now is very much, you know, just for the last 20 odd years, has been working with emerging technology businesses. I sort of came sort of prior to that very much from an enterprise level, started off as a propeller head as a computer programmer at BHP, one too many decades ago. That set me up in technology. I then actually got involved in a software house that actually was headquartered out of New Zealand, as it turned out. And we were putting in retail and merchandising management systems. We put in some of the first retail management systems here in WA. Bunnings was one of our major clients back in the day. But from that, I actually got involved with consulting. And so I actually joined Arthur Young at that stage. And that's the Young side of Ernst & Young. So I was there pre-merger. In those days, I could actually say that I was from the Young side, not so much today. And so I was with Ernst & Young for quite a period of time. And then from there, I actually got headhunted into SGIO Insurance. SGIO Insurance was one of the government trading enterprises here in WA. At that point in time, that's when West Australia was actually, and a lot of governments were actually privatising some of their operations. And so in 92, 93, actually, we actually listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. During that time, I headed up IT and innovation for SGIO until NRMA acquired us at the end of 99. I joined a small not-for-profit at that point in time, but we syndicated with a number of other players in Perth and three others, and actually were successful in securing the West Australian license for a technology incubator, an IT incubator, and which really was the first tech incubator in Perth. And that was part of a federal government program called the BITS program.
Right.
And that sort of starts to merge into what I'm currently doing. So we actually managed federal government money to actually invest in IT startups. It was a different way of actually managing the money, and that was really quite an interesting approach. But we would have looked at, over about 8 years, 500 different ideas. Some of those ideas were commercial opportunities. Quite a lot of them were just good ideas. We then sort of invested in around about 30 of those. And out of that 30, 10 of them we failed real fast.
Mm-hmm.
10 of them actually failed on their own right.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 of them we actually managed to, they managed to survive. Some of them we actually sold and exited. And indeed, actually a couple of them I'm still on the board of today.
Wow.
And so I guess just to put that in the context of my whole journey, started off in technology, understood what it could do, understood that it could actually impact. That Ernst & Young time was very much about understanding what innovation could actually do for companies. SGIO was very much about how do we actually commercialize that innovation to position us, which we then got taken out. My current business, or the one that I actually set up back, the tech incubator Entrepreneurs in Residence,
mm-hmm.
Actually taught me about how you could actually invest in that commercialization and make a quid out of it. So that's really been my journey over the last 40 years.
Okay, all right. Well, I guess just for anyone listening to know, we worked together for I think for the Entrepreneurs Program, Accelerating Commercialization for a while. How long were you with the program for?
I was only with just over two and a quarter years.
So still it was a significant amount of time, given it was only just a bit over 3 years for me. So since then, is it only a recent thing that you formed your consulting business?
No, in fact, actually, I've got a couple of advisory practices, actually. One which is actually Entrepreneurs in Residence, which we actually formed to run the technology incubator.
Yep.
When we completed that federal government contract, I actually acquired that business and it's now mine.
Right.
It's very much where I focus on that sort of startup ecosystem, early stage investment readiness, capitalizing startups or emerging tech. My other advisory practice that I'm in partnership with a couple of other guys, Triangle Equity Partners, is where we actually play more at that scale up level and stay up level.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess across those, I tend to get involved in startups, scale ups and stay ups.
Okay. So I guess we're framing this from the other side of the equation. I've interviewed a few people who, people who advise and consult. I think what's interesting with you is that, and it may be exactly the same, but as somebody from the east of Australia, Western Australia is so far away that it's not really clear what the ecosystem looks like there. Maybe tell us a little bit about what's different or what's the same over in the West. The hothouse of innovation, you know, getting moved over into some sort of a commercialization pathway.
It's a really good question, actually. I think I think the snapshot is, because you're quite right, we are actually quite a long way away, from the eastern states. But it does sort of generate a level of independence, a level of self-determination, a level and so on. Over here, there is actually quite a strong, very vibrant entrepreneurial ecosystem, an entrepreneurial and startup ecosystem. As we might get into a little bit later, I'd actually suggest that there's definitely three levels of innovation ecosystems in WA.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very strong entrepreneurial startup ecosystem that's got really strong over the last, you know, sort of 10, 20 years. We have quite a significant supply chain and other areas that deal into our major economy. And so I'd put a lot of those businesses at that scale up, established business,
mm-hmm.
scale up, mid-tier ecosystem. And then we've actually got quite a large stay up or enterprise level ecosystem. And in fact, actually, when you start to look at the anatomy of our economy, which is what I've been observing for the last 20 years, or more for that matter, really, we have absolute strengths in Western Australia, dominated and in fact creates us natural entitlements to succeed in certain areas because of our dominant industries of mining, energy, agriculture. And in fact, actually, I would say that we're starting to build quite strengths in some other sectors as well. Our fourth industry really is education,
mm-hmm.
With a lot of exports, but medical is actually where we're becoming really quite strong as well. And I'd say actually where we're starting to see growth is because of our geography. While we're quite a long way away from Sydney, quite frankly, it's just as easy for me to fly to Singapore and deal up there than it is for me to go to Melbourne.
Yeah, absolutely right. So, sorry, go on, sorry.
No, it's just that does colour where we're actually at. So I think I can talk more about that which actually does influence us in terms of some of the software and hardware that fits into the mining and energy sector. I mean, it's long said that actually the Silicon Valley of mining is actually Western Australia.
Yeah.
We've had more software companies that are coming out. Queensland's very much like us as well, but that's predominantly where we're at.
So we have
a supply chain.
So what's the dynamics of that? So are there Are there those who come up with ideas within the big mining companies or the big, you know, organisations in Western Australia who go, okay, I've got this thing, I'm going to jump out of this business and I'm going to go and spin this up? Or is it large organisations who have got some sort of corporate venturing program who are spinning out opportunities, or just random people tinkering in their garages?
It is actually a little bit different to that. So I would suggest, the way I describe our anatomy, yeah, we've got big companies in terms of mining, energy, and so on. We've got like something like 400 plus businesses in WA, which are over, you know, sort of 200. So I think we're into the sort of large ones. I'd actually suggest that most of those are actually operational branches of the large corporates in Australia.
Right.
And in fact, I would probably go as far as to say that there's a limited number of actual corporates, big brand corporates, headquarters here in WA, compared to Melbourne and Sydney, even Queensland for that matter. And so what we have over here is very large organisations servicing the big industries, but they're operational headquarters. Now, the impact of what you're just sort of talking there is that that if you want to engage with a large corporate, you've really got to get into the decision maker.
Right.
Well, the decision maker is in the eastern states.
Right.
Right. They're sort of not here, but we have quite large supply chain businesses servicing the big guys.
Right.
And that's where the growth is actually coming in, and a lot of those sort of software, hardware, services, engineering. The challenge with that is that they tended to be services-based organizations servicing the big boys,
mm-hmm.
right, not product-based. And that's the shift that we're starting to see over here in WA, okay. is that we've got some quite significant dollars coming through that supply chain wallet, right? We've got people that are actually have been strong relationship, developed strong domain expertise in terms of being able to service the needs of these big guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they're now starting to, and what we're calling cross-sector,
mm-hmm.
they're now starting to turn that know-how from services delivery into product.
Okay.
And so that is actually starting to shift our economy over here. If I was to go back to the mining, but, you know, for decades, mining actually really wasn't that technologically advanced, just big CapEx, dug dirt out of the ground, crushed it, chipped it, sent it offshore, did it again, and bigger and faster.
It's a business model that worked.
It did work. But over time, different regulations and different imperatives have caused, you know, safety issues and so on,
mm-hmm.
Production issues, competition issues. And so we've now started to see a lot of automated automation of vehicles over here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the largest robot in the world is actually in the northwest of Western Australia.
Oh, really?
It's a remote autonomous train up in the Pilbara that's about, I don't know, God knows how many miles long.
Yep.
Right? But it's remote and managed.
Wow.
Right? And so WA today, in terms of that sort of area, is probably the centre of excellence for remote autonomous operation in the world.
Wow.
Right?
Okay.
And a good example of that is that Woodside actually has joint ventures with NASA in terms of the remote autonomous operations. You need to sit down and go, why is that?
Oh, well, I reckon I can guess.
As it turns out, that the need is to have remote autonomous operation into hostile environments.
Mm.
And an oil rig and a space station are both hostile environments.
Yep.
So, no, they're testing some of their equipment over here. So these are the things that are starting to influence some of the, you know, the know-how and imagination for creating new ideas in WA.
I'm imagining that somebody listening to this, I guess it could be all sorts of people, but one cohort would probably be local aspiring entrepreneurs who want to get involved somehow. I'm also imagining that there might be businesses over in the east who are thinking, should I relocate, or should I? Are there innovations that I've got that I could actually present to the economy in Western Australia? I guess if they are where do you land? Like, if you are an aspiring entrepreneur and you're based in West Australia and maybe you're not across the sort of information that you've got, are there relationships with the universities that are important? I know there are funds here in Victoria, and obviously there's government grants and whatnot. The port of call or the ports of call that people could consider when they're thinking about Western Australia as a possible place to operate from or to market to?
Yeah. So I think with anything in those sorts of areas, you've got to have some idea, some sort of solution that's actually solving a real world problem. The best thing is how do you actually connect to the customer mm-hmm. in terms of doing that? Then you're looking at, do we have an ecosystem that can support you to commercialize that in terms of going forward? Because we are a bit of a mining town, I actually refer to this in terms of tenements of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
We have really quite a very vibrant, extensive, and Melbourne does too, and in some areas it's stronger in some domains than what we have over here, and so is Sydney and Queensland. But once you've actually got an idea of who you're trying to tackle, we're starting to get better at actually providing that map of those tenements of innovation to where to land,
mm-hmm.
Where to actually set yourself up to be able to build the right capabilities to be able to commercialize that. We've in the past, had some challenges in terms of, providing of capital. And so we've been trying to address that over time. I was lucky to be part of that sort of first tech incubator, and we were actually using federal government money to invest in startups. But, at the end of the day, you can only do so many, you can't do a lot.
Yep.
There's still really quite a gap in that. So I was actually lucky to be able to work with a couple of guys, and we established the Perth Angels.
Is that what you won the award for? Just segue there.
Yes, it is. Yep. And that award was in recognition of, effort put in to try and develop an ecosystem over here. And we've extended that a little bit in terms of that angel level funding in terms of Perth Angels, Southwest Angels, Mindaroo have actually now sponsoring the Black Angels.
Right.
So there's a good degree of activity going in that area. But just recently, we're starting to see some venture funds actually establish themselves here. So there's a series of new venture funds that are happening. I'm trying to collaborate with another guy to actually open up a shingle as a venture partner for a Singaporean-based fund.
Right.
So hopefully we can start to get more capital to actually support that level of activity.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So you kind of touched on an area I wanted to sort of tease out a little bit. So it sounds like the angel and pre-seed, I guess, ecosystem is starting to evolve. I guess if you contrast it to where it was about 10 years ago, is it materially different or?
Absolutely materially different. And again, what's sort of really interesting in my observation over time is that, there would have been a lot of players, high net worths, that really just focused 20 odd years ago, would have just focused themselves buying listed stocks on the Australian Stock Exchange. In fact, you go back 15, 20 years ago, the story really was that Western Australia's venture capital industry was called the ASX.
Right.
but we were investing in then, we were still putting that sort of $2, $3, $5 million, but that was really just going into exploration stocks, And so why would you say, putting some money into an exploration stock that there might be some ore within that pile of dirt, as to those, why wouldn't you actually put it into a software technology business that may actually, and in fact, actually, I had a conversation with one guy once, and he said the biggest difference that he found was that I can price a ton of ore. 15 years ago, I couldn't have priced an IT transaction.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Today,
you can.
It's, you know, it's all very much an accepted way I'm doing it. I can price it today. I couldn't back then. So it is materially different in that we've now also starting to see those players, and there's a new generation coming through in the mining and energy and so on, that realise that technology can shift the dial, and that they realise that maybe if they take a position in that technology, they might be able to shift that, shift their wealth.
Oh.
And so that I think is, I think it's, in my, it's on, we're on the cusp of that changing right now.
So what's the interconnectivity, if you like, between, so, you know, there's friends, family and fans, you know, there's the angels sort of, you know, 20 maybe to 100 K, and then there's a handoff over into, you know, more venture capital, you know, Series A, et cetera, et cetera. And I might comment, it's funny, whilst I've only visited Western Australia a couple of times, in my dealings, I bumped into these backdoor listings with companies who was kind of, you know, just, you know, the Walking Dead on the ASX. And that was a legitimate way. This was back in the early 2000s, late 90s. That was the way to get, and I guess it was during the dot-com boom period. Everybody had this pathway to the ASX, which is, you know, you can interpret it as, in some businesses, it's actually the exit. It's not a cap raise per se because they need money for something. It's the way to get the original investors out, and then it goes to mums and dads. Yeah, that's right. But for some businesses, it was a cap raising exercise / PR exercise. So we'll raise our profile, raise some money, and, you know, off to the races we go again. Pardon me. My impression is, and correct me here, that's not as prevalent now.
Oh, no, not by a long shot. No, WA, they used to talk about the White Tuber Grade, I think. You know, that was probably more Queensland, but, you know, I think we were the cowboys of the West. That's my point. There was actually quite a formulaic way of actually raising capital that involved going to the ASX.
Mm-hmm.
There was some innovations, if you could call it that, in terms of how you could bring a venture into the ASX. And in fact, I'll explain just a bit more of what you just said, but to me, that was actually one of the biggest inhibitors that we had in terms of raising private investors, mm-hmm. capital from private investors, where it was far more mature in those sectors, that segments, you know, Melbourne and Sydney and so on. So what was actually happening was that getting onto the ASX is you can either come in through the front door, an IPO, or you come in through the back door called an RTO.
Mm.
We had quite a significant period of time where technology stocks were coming in through the back door because there were some ventures that actually did raise quite a number of capital to actually going out and dig the dirt to see if there's any value there. There actually wasn't. So they ended up with only a limited amount of money left and no value in the business. And so they tended to use that money as a bit of a honeypot to actually attract technology businesses to backdoor into them.
Mm-hmm.
We called a reverse takeover, that technology company then actually owned. Unfortunately, what that meant was that all the mums and dads that actually had nice shares within the original IPO were now crunched to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our corporate advisors that last week they were, you know, mining experts and gurus. This week they're now technology experts and gurus.
Right.
And unfortunately, a lot of those businesses that were RTO'd just weren't mature enough.
Yeah.
To actually, and so, you know, it's like on the stock exchange, unless you're actually showing significant movement to keep the sentiment up, you eventually go on a decline.
Yep.
And so we ended up with a number of our RTOs very poorly valued eventually. And so WA was actually the capital of RTOs in Australia. Fortunately, what's happened is that the federal, ASX and ASIC actually lifted the hurdle of what needed to be done in an RTO, which is almost the same as an IPO.
Yep.
And so that stopped a lot of that activity.
Yeah, fair enough too. So I want to circle back a little bit to the university. So my experience here in the East is that the universities, you know, the in the old days, they would have intellectual property that they had rights over. It would be gathering dust. They'd be in just filing cabinets somewhere. Nobody was doing a lot with it. Then it was the period of technology transfer, trying to get it into some sort of a vehicle where it can go out into the market. Now they're reinventing themselves again, and I guess possibly modelling themselves a little bit off the US, where there's a tension between academia, you know, research, you know, the bread and butter of the university, which is to educate, and then on the other side of that, on the other side of that page, is this. I guess a series of initiatives, and Melbourne University is a good one, but they're all doing it to one degree or another, where they've got a bit of a tension between the two, where they're trying to do the technology transfer thing, but they're also trying to incubate and accelerate and develop. They've got postdocs or PhDs or whatever who have got IP and have got something which, you know, on the face of things looks possibly revolutionary, who perhaps don't want to be the guy or the gal who's going to head this up. So, you know, I'm an engineer, or I'm a scientist of some description. I don't see myself as a CEO. Matter for you how you want to handle it. And they kind of put themselves in the hands of it. So then the universities go off and say, okay, well, let's find a CEO and let's find a, you know, you be the CTO or whatever. But they also now have got access to capital, or, you know, they're contributing a percentage and then having institutional funds coming in, or even private money coming into our fund with a mandate. Is that, and my own view is that that's healthy for the ecosystem, particularly if there's competition between the universities, or some of the universities have got specific areas of expertise. So Melbourne Uni is obviously, you know, big in medicine, so maybe there's medtech there. You know, other universities, more engineering or whatnot. What's the relationship like with industry and the universities in Western Australia?
Actually, very good. And again, it's really interesting for a population of 2.6 million or whatever. You know, we've got five universities over here. And so, you know, we do very well in terms of the number of universities that we've got. And they've, each of them have actually grown, you know, in this whole area of how do they support, you know, the fundamental research that they're doing, and being able to translate that into commercial offerings. We have actually sitting alongside the universities here some really, really top-notch research centres. So, you know, we've got Curtin University, University of Western Australia, Murdoch University, Edith Cowan University, Notre Dame University, but you know, we've got likes of Harry Perkins, Harry Perkins Centre, which is linked to UWA. You've got Perrin, you've got the Telethon Kids Institute, Lion's Eye Institute, Lion's Ear Institute, and these are just fantastic tenements of innovation and research and innovation, and they really are quite world leading. It's the challenge then of how do you actually get that research and translate it into some sort of commercial outcome where we've tried to get better at over time. So some of the universities have started to institute. So if I was to take Curtin University, you know, they've been running a program called supporting a lot of their researchers, but also bringing in industry and private research, a program called Ignition. Mm-hmm. Ignition actually came in about 13 years ago. It's actually modelled very strongly on and was based on Ignite out of Cambridge University,
right.
Judge Business School over there. And so I think they've had something like, I don't know, it's the 13th year. I wouldn't be surprised if it's 700 odd ideas that have gone through that, and a number of them actually have gone on to raise capital. They've then actually established a thing called Curtin Accelerate, Mm-hmm. And so curtain accelerate actually is the sort of like the next stage on beyond, you know, curtain ignition. Curtain is also one of the trailblazer projects nationally, particularly around critical minerals, you know, in taking leadership there. You've got UWA, which is probably, Curtin's good at medical as well, but, you know, UWA is very strong in sort of medical, particularly with their, you know, their linkage with Harry Perkins Institute, Harry Perkins Institute, and Perrins around there and so on. You know, Edith Cowan is pretty strong in sort of, you know, some of the health related and some engineering. They were very strong at one point in time in terms of photonics and engineering. And so it goes on. Murdoch, very strong in veterinary and agriculture. So they've got their probably their areas, and they're getting better at how do they support the translation from that fundamental research to into commercial outcomes. Curtin's probably done more in terms of spinning those ideas out and creating structures.
Mm-hmm.
Edith Cowan probably is one of the top 10 cyber research institutes in the world.
Really?
Like here. And so they're very strong in that part as well. So we've had to learn and get better. Some of them have put in sort of limited amount of funding to actually help get commercialize that to a point.
Mm-hmm.
And some have been a lot stronger at developing licensing arrangements to take it into market. And some have been stronger in terms of spin outs to actually get them as private enterprises and grow through that particular way. And of course, we've got our big corporates. You know, there's chairs from Optus and Shell and Diet and BHP.
So do the universities have a fund per se rather than funding to sort of spin up their capability?
Yeah, no, they haven't really. There's not any that actually has a university fund.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at this particular point, yeah, they have funds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you know, there's the Pathfinder Fund. You know, that sits within UWA. Curtin has its own internal funds that, you know, can help commercialize, and you know, and so they do treat it in that sort of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not like a big venture fund.
Yep.
That is managed from some endowment. There's some good activity trying to actually, there's a group that actually did manage a venture fund here in Perth that are now starting to help structure and help migrate that philanthropic funding
mm-hmm.
that was being dispersed over a huge amount of, you know, sort of fundamental research to actually try and focus that into help still supporting that, but now utilize that money to get it to a commercializable
mm-hmm.
And therefore attract the private funding.
Yeah, okay. It occurs to me too that one of the universities, sort of back to the unis, and I'll let them go in a minute, but they rely a lot on their reputation. And the reputation then allows them to connect with other universities around the world and kind of leverage off their brand and their activities. Do Western Australian universities have an outreach program, say into the Middle East or into America, all those sorts of things?
Yeah. And again, because it's probably us recognizing our geography. A number of the universities have satellite branches in Indonesia, in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Cowan, I think, has got one in the Middle East. You know, Singapore, Malaysia. You know, sort of they do recognise that, are very much focused on that international connectivity,
mm-hmm.
Traction. I think our universities are probably stronger in some countries, over and above what would be other cities in Australia, but you know. Now, Melbourne has a very strong Indian relationship.
Yeah,
we do too. Probably not as strong as what Melbourne does.
Yeah, sure. I'll leave universities for now. So I might. We did a little bit of work, mentoring or whatever they called us with the Mindaroo Foundation, in terms of Indigenous entrepreneurship. I haven't. I'm just trying to remember. I haven't bumped into anything like that over here in the East. That's not to say it's not here, but I just haven't seen it. What's the current situation with supporting Indigenous entrepreneurship in Western Australia?
Yeah, in fact, actually, there's a lot of activity going on in that area. So there's actually focused groups that actually are establishing to support that. So I mean, Mindaroo, has been great in spawning off some different sorts of areas, but there's been a lot of other really good groups also in that. From an entrepreneurial side of things, there is a group that just kicked off, when I say just kicked off, probably a year ago, and it's called First Nations X. Okay. And so it's all about how and supporting on Indigenous entrepreneurs. That's a fantastic group of people, which, by the way, headed up by non-Indigenous and Indigenous people, but with strong commercialization and business skills. A business partner of mine, actually, in one of my businesses, actually one of the directors of First Nations X.
Right.
So we're seeing, part of that is giving that support, but also there has been an establishment of a angel group in the Indigenous side of things, and that's called the Black Angels.
Right.
And so that's sort of kicking off as we speak, and that's being supported through sort of Mindaroo. So there is a, I think, and everything can be always stronger, and it is evolving, can be a lot better, and so on. But I think we've got the foundations of support now and focus, both from the entrepreneurial side of the coin and the investor side of the coin.
Okay. So, acknowledging that, we're both pasty white men, what are the challenges just in, high level that Indigenous entrepreneurs face, in your view?
I think in a lot of areas it's actually it comes down to probably understanding how do you commercialize a venture.
Mm-hmm.
And so
same thing as everyone.
Absolutely. One of the things I had the really good fortune with Mindaroo, about 2 or 3 years ago, of actually sitting alongside, but I was delivering the investor side of the angel investing 101 type training right around the country. Mm-hmm. We did most of it during COVID, so therefore it was mostly virtual.
Right.
Because I talked to a lot of and some of the ventures that we got them to pitch to the to the investors, we're absolutely quite amazing in terms of the depth from I would say Indigenous food. Art, but equally in areas of cyber, some of these technologies, and just, this is what I'm saying, it probably fits us all.
Yep.
But the depth and breadth of it was just, some of that stuff is just sort of 7 layers above my head.
Yep.
I think a lot of what we see with a lot of a lot of ventures is how do you communicate to investors and build that relationship and understand how you communicate. And I've got to say, a story that I just found was so beautiful was that how we actually do welcome to country.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the same challenge that female entrepreneurs have, as well as even Indigenous and other part of the population. But how do you create a relationship? And I found this almost, as these Indigenous entrepreneurs were establishing what country they're from,
mm.
It almost created a relationship with the investors, and they knew how to talk to each other.
Yep.
It was just mind-boggling how good. And so if we can grow that sort of Indigenous investor, there's going to be a better connection of communication to understand where they're coming from and build that chemistry to actually fund these ventures. And it's the same with female entrepreneurs. There is a real challenge in the gender mix, and communications in the gender mix. Unfortunately, female entrepreneurs get asked questions differently than male entrepreneurs.
Do they really?
And ask questions differently as to whether or not they're a male investor or a female investor. And there's empirical studies all around the world that says that.
Really? Okay.
And there are ways to get around it.
Yep.
And I'm focusing on that with my partner in Entrepreneurs in Residence. So the challenges for them, I think, is the environment that they sit within, understanding where there's a deep problem that needs to be solved.
Yep.
There is the communication with prospective funders. So how do you solve those sorts of issues? So I think things like the Black Angel starting up, I think, is a marvelous thing for Indigenous entrepreneurs. Indigenous entrepreneurs now are starting to, are very much involved in a plethora of societal and technology problems that they actually are able to actually solve. Some of them actually are driven by their Indigenous culture. And one of the things that, IP Australia, I'm not sure if you're aware, but IP Australia is actually working on how to actually establish patenting, mm-hmm. in a way, protection policies on Indigenous knowledge.
Really? Okay. That's interesting.
It's a really a wonderful area that they're doing that. So if you think about it, how do we now protect Indigenous art, and if that's actually Indigenous knowledge, and if we've got, support in terms of doing that, that's going to be marvellous for our Indigenous ventures.
I have to confess, so I did my Master's in Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and the major final year assignment that I worked on was Indigenous Entrepreneurship. So I've got I had some insights when we did that work. Some of the things that popped out back then, and that's, 15 years ago or something now, that popped out were things like if an Indigenous individual went out and was successful somehow in terms of their, say their art venture or whatever it was, and then suddenly now they're all cashed up, there was an expectation that wealth would be distributed amongst the community. Whereas for you and me, if we made money, then we kind of secure it, we put it away or reinvest it back into the business so the business can grow, and then we try and scale it. So, that's one of the things that I remember was this real contrast between cultures. And also I've bumped into that in the South Pacific as well. So you have individuals who come here, they do fruit picking or whatever, and they've got $20,000 that they've saved up. They go back into the community, and some of them have to give it to their village. So the money's gone basically, and there isn't that thinking. The other thing that I bumped into, which I thought was even more interesting in a way, was that there were some aspects of flora in the Australian outback that had medicinal purposes. And so, me being me, I'm thinking, wow, this is, let's turn it into a product and whatever. But then there are challenges around, a Westerner might go, we're going to farm these particular plants, whereas in the traditional cultures, they're basically gathering those there. And so you can't scale, you can't without impacting on the environment or suddenly somehow possibly diminishing, the ways in which they're doing things. So there are some tricky things there in how you have, it's not just about sustainability, but authentically or sticking to traditional methods.
Yeah, and I think a lot of those traditional things and that authenticity is actually part of the value that's there.
Yeah,
and I think you're quite right. It's a matter of now how do you actually manage that between, a scalable business model and that. So yes, you've actually got to work through that. I just find that there seems to be a lot of Indigenous entrepreneurs that are working through those business models.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the areas that you're talking about, it's pretty hard to protect some of that, even if you do that.
Mm.
And that's really quite excited about the Indigenous knowledge that, that IP Australia are actually sorting out.
Mm-hmm.
They can come up with a way to actually protect that.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, we've actually got scalable business models that can protect the ground.
Right.
Now we can start to attract, classic and traditional investment, into that. I just found talking to a lot of the Indigenous business people, which are extremely successful businesses, you know, what I found they were getting excited about angel level type investing is that, you know, they could reapply their money, mm-hmm. right? And it still supports that level of self-determination.
Yep.
But in a sustainable way. So, yeah, I think there's challenges in all of our different ecosystems, but
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think if we can get that, you know, like First Nation X supporting the entrepreneurship and how you handle a lot of these sort of issues, Black Angels out there in terms of investing, you know, okay, in that.
And I guess you're spending less time, you know, explaining it to people who aren't familiar with the challenges again and again and again and again. Suddenly everyone in the room's got the memo. Everyone knows.
What you've just described there is sort of like what I, as an observer, saw within these mock pitch sessions.
Yep.
When, you know, an entrepreneur goes, you know, my name's Jenny and I'm a proud woman from blah, blah, you know, from that particular area, and you know, the you know, the business guy sitting as the angels on the other side of the table, you know, I just saw these two people go bang, and they knew exactly what they were talking to each other about.
Right.
And I thought, you know, I thought, man, you don't see that happening too quickly.
Okay, so I've got a question for you. So, if you had a magic wand, what would you like to see? Like three things you'd like to see improved in Western Australia with regards to innovation, entrepreneurship, and I guess really capitalising on the intellectual, engine that is there.
I think it's actually, I'm not sure I've got these in any order, but one would definitely be, let's actually recognise that we've actually got three ecosystems and three ecosystem strata, not just one.
Mm-hmm.
We're having a huge amount of effort, and I think we're becoming successful, and it's been fantastic. And we ought not be doing anything less and still doing more in our startup and entrepreneurial ecosystem. I think that's fantastic. But I think we need to actually start recognizing the differences, the same, but the differences in the other strata. And I think if we can get those nuances sorted out, the key thing would then be able to start getting linkages between, you know, the sort of local customer base,
mm-hmm.
the big guy,
yep.
right, to actually get our first customers into that. So I think that would be the first thing. Let's get clear as to the differences and understand those differences of how we can create new language. I think a second thing for me would be, while I think it's great that we've actually now started to get some VC and venture funding levels in WA, which would be really good, I would like to actually see a greater growth at that sort of early stage private investor mm-hmm. Side of thing. And I think that's an education and start to increase the investment catchment area.
Yeah. Is there... Can I ask, I know you've got a third one to tell me, is there something, we've got Breakthrough here in Victoria. Do you have something similar there?
No, I don't have a Breakthrough program in Victoria.
Yeah, okay.
What's that?
I say it's a Victorian government, I don't know how many billions of dollars that they're allocating into the market for innovation, entrepreneurial ventures that they're getting behind. It's a grant program.
Okay.
But it's big, very big. I think it's $2 billion, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so we wouldn't have that level of that being allocated over here. We've got a new industries fund, you know, that's got probably in the orders of 16 to 20 million, you know, 23 million, I think.
You've got that in your back pocket right now, I know you.
The state government needs to probably, and it is trying to address that sort of area in terms of focus. You know, they've established now an innovation strategy where they're trying to get focus into those sorts of areas. And I think actually if we can actually get those linkages between the different strata, you know, I think that will actually open up more wallets,
sure.
you know, in terms of that. So recognition of the different strata to help get that connection, expand that down at the sort of the private investor level to actually... Because I think the more well-structured ventures that are connected to customers, as you know, by their very nature, they're going to attract larger licks of money.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you do first? That's where I reckon you're sort of doing that. And I think, which we are starting to do, which I think would actually help in those sort of ventures, is really leverage the natural entitlements that we've got here, where we are super strong in sort of remote autonomous operations. We've actually got a space and Earth Congress actually happening in Perth today, tomorrow, next week. So some of the stuff that we build for these sort of, areas can actually are looking at how they can cross sector into new emerging, sectors like space. Remote health. We actually hold the probably the largest geographical footprint of any health department in the world.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
Why don't we leverage that national entitlement geography?
Mm.
There are the sort of some of the things that maybe this is a sort of fourth one, but promote some of our success stories that we've got over here, because we've got some amazing things. Like I said, largest robot in the world. Who knew that?
Yeah,
we work with NASA. Who knew that? We've got the Square Kilometre Array over here, which is like the largest radio telescope on the planet, sitting over here. There's some real natural entitlements of success that the rest of the world should know about. And yeah. Here's a good place to come and build something here.
Fantastic. Look, I think that's a great point to stop at. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how people can get in touch with you, what the best sort of way is, and anything else you'd like to let them know?
Oh, I think the simplest way is probably just get onto LinkedIn. Find me that way and message me, and within that, if they've got anything they'd like to talk about in terms of commercializing their technology, getting themselves investment ready, or they want to sort of connect into the West Australian marketplace, that's a good way to sort of start. One of my more recent passions is now. I've done a lot of work in the startup and scale-up area, I'm now starting to, with a colleague, we're playing more at that sort of mid-tier to stay-up sort of level, to the big enterprise. And so we really want to get a common discourse about what innovation management really means.
Yep.
And so we've launched the Australian Innovation Management Institute. And so if anyone's really keen on understanding innovation management and in fact actually getting themselves certified as a innovation management professional, connect on LinkedIn. Love to have a chat to them.
Okay. Does that have a website yet?
Yeah, it's the AIM, it's AIMInstitute.org.wa, So it's not the Australian Institute of Management, which is a lovely place and, do a lot of really fantastic stuff. It's AIMInstitute.org.au.
Got it. No worries. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your insights today. I really, really appreciate it. Today was fantastic, and also you were a pleasure to work with when we did the stuff through the Entrepreneurs Program.
That's great.
Please stay in touch. As I continue to do these, if there's another opportunity to get you on, and if there's something specific you want to talk about, you're more than welcome.
And if you want to talk to anyone else, or you're in WA, just give me a yell, and I'll. Because, like I say, fantastic place, best place in the world to actually establish a headquarters and travel the world.
Yeah, well, certainly, I'm interested in an Indigenous entrepreneur who I can have a meaningful conversation with. That'd be great.
First Nations X might be a great place to actually connect with one of the guys and have a chat about that.
Fantastic.
So I'll get that offline.
No worries. All the best. Enjoy the rest of your day. See you, Greg. Okay, so that was Greg Reby. I had the pleasure of working with Greg. He's a really, he's a gentleman's gentleman. He really knows his stuff and he really cares about innovation and entrepreneurship in Western Australia. I hope you enjoyed that. and hopefully we'll have him again on sometime. This podcast is brought to you by Christo Partners, strategic advisors to assist you in commercializing your innovations. If you have an opportunity you seek to bring to market and need help with either going to market, connecting with universities to access technology, or raising capital or any other matter, contact us on hello@christopartners.com. This podcast is also brought to you by FinHawk, digital risk advice and services. FinHawk offers a range of services, including their B2RF, a cybersecurity breach readiness recovery service that anticipates and readies businesses to respond proactively to a cybersecurity incident. In an era where cyber threat persists, the genuine test services post-data breach. FinHawk offers a confidential service to streamline post-breach response to reduce impact and ensure the rapid resumption of operations. Contact FinHawk at hello@finhawk.com.au.